Today, November the 11th of 2018, is the 100th anniversary of armistice in Europe that concluded World War I. Today, I'm going to present an expose from Military History Magazine on that particular war, and we'll concentrate on one specific battle. In the second session, we'll note World War II and a specific battle that occurred on that occasion. And therefore, we will celebrate what is known as Veterans Day in the process. I think that what we're going to note today is very important because we need to remember back on how we acquired our freedom on two different occasions. And this is when there was an evil adversary that advanced upon our client nation. And we do need to go back and see what we can find out about the lives that were committed to the concept of freedom. So many people died on our behalf, and therefore that has continued to the present hour. First of all, let's learn about Veterans Day. It's an annual holiday in the United States honoring veterans of the armed forces and also the men and women killed in the country's wars. The observance originated as Armistice Day, which was set aside by the United States, Great Britain, and France to commemorate the ending of World War I. After World War II, it was recognized as a day of tribute to the veterans and the dead of that conflict as well. In Canada, it became known as Remembrance Day, and in Great Britain, the Sunday nearest November 11 was proclaimed Remembrance Sunday, honoring the dead of both world wars. In 1954, after the Korean War, the date was officially designated in the United States as Veterans Day to honor the servicemen of all U.S. wars. Veterans Day is annually observed with parades, speeches, and floral tributes placed on servicemen's graves and memorials. Special Veterans Day services are held at Arlington National Cemetery in Arlington, Virginia, and at similar shrines in other countries. A soldier sends a dramatic yarn to a friend, and we get this from that introduction. Almost one-third of the Americans killed in World War I lost their lives during the Meuse River Argonne Forest Campaign, which was in fact three successive strikes beginning on September 26th of 1918 against entrenched German troops. The densely wooded rolling terrain of northeastern France favored the Germans, who had been fortifying their lines since they captured the region 4 years earlier. Virtually none of the U.S. soldiers involved in the first wave of the attack had ever been in battle before. But with support from the French, the troops made slow but steady progress against fierce resistance. As the second phase commenced in early October, two battalions of Americans were pinned down in a ravine for five hellish days. When the Germans suggested they surrender, the Americans yelled back certain expletives that, even untranslated, could be easily understood to mean no. Reinforcements were rushed in and the troops were saved. The third assault, which began on November 1st, battered the Germans into a full surrender, and that was a week and a half later. The Meuse-Argonne offensive lasted 47 days and involved 1.2 million Americans. In the early evening of October the 2nd, 1918, 554 American doughboys, whom popular history dubbed the Lost Battalion, filed down the southern slope of a ravine in the depths of the Argonne Forest in France. Though the bottom of the ravine, a muddy morass, snaked the Claravoix Brook, it was therefore spanned by a narrow plank bridge. And the men of the 77th Division lined up to cross, having learned the value of dry feet. Their commander, Major Charles Whittlesey, a lanky, fastidious former Wall Street lawyer watched them cross from a bridge behind them. To the north in the fading light, he could just make out the chalk cliff backdrop of their objective, the Clairvaux Road. Whittlesey's men had done well. They had managed to slip through an unmanned gap in the German trench line on Hill 198. Now with the Clairvaux Road in sight and no German resistance on the hill, Whittlesey took advantage of the remaining daylight and ordered his men to their objective. They established a position about 300 yards long and 60 yards deep, but just below the road on the reverse slope of the hill. Although the slope was steep and rocky, the weary infantrymen dug in swiftly, machine gun sections consisting of French chalet light machine guns called Shoshos. And heavy Loch Ness machine guns were posted on the flanks east and west. Runner posts had been established every 100 yards back along the route to march to maintain contact with the rear. Patrols coming in supported the surrounding terrain, and therefore they were clear of the enemy, so the position on the reverse slope of the hill seemed to be secure. The exhausted men under Whittlesey's command, whose wool blankets and overcoats had been left to the rear, settled down for a cold but quiet night. Get some concept here of who this fellow is. Major Charles W. Whittlesey, commander 1st Battalion, 308th Infantry of the 77th Infantry Division, American Special Forces in War I. The Argonne Forest, France, October 2 through 7 of 1918, of 650 soldiers, 194 survived. This is the best I could do from the internet. What you have, though, is a situation where these men are going to be boxed in. And this little circle here is where this occurs. They're surrounded by the enemy. They did not think they were, but they were surrounded by the enemy. And you can see that this is the area in which they are bottled up. You have all kinds of artillery that are being fired at them from all sides. And so they are trapped, and they can only hope to hold out and see if they can survive. You have less than 200 people who walked away from this site after 650 walked in. So that gives you some idea, and I'll leave this up on the board for you. Now, the first light American patrol sent out on the flanks and rear encountered small German patrols. The Germans, who had previously occupied position on Hill 198, had shifted forces westward 24 hours earlier to reinforce defenses against the French. Once they were satisfied that the western flank was secure for the time being, the Germans began shifting troops back to the trenches on Hill 198. The seam in the defenses through which Whittlesey's unit had infiltrated the previous evening was now closed. At 8:30 a.m., trench mortar shells began to rain in on the Americans from preoccupied German positions. The shells did little damage because of the protection provided by the reverse slope of the position. At mid-morning, word came through that the chain of runners posted to the rear had been broken. Attempts to reestablish the post were met with heavy machine gun fire from positions vacated by the Germans the day before. Whittlesey's command was cut off. At noon on October 3rd, he ordered his officers, "Our mission is to hold this position at all costs, no falling back. Have this understood by every man in your command." Isolated from friendly forces and surrounded by a determined enemy, the men of the Lost Battalion stood their ground, enduring incessant machine gun fire, mortar shells, grenades, sniper fire, and vicious ground assaults led by flamethrowers. For 5 dreadful days, with cold, thirst, hunger, fatigue, pain-numbing fear, misery, and death, their constant companion of the men of the Lost Battalion, held on. Long past hope, long past relief. On October 7th, the 554 7th Division men who had entered the ravine, 194 officers and enlisted men, staggered out, bearing 107 dead and 159 wounded. Since this article was written, those numbers have been updated. Killed in action were 122. Those wounded, 242. Those evacuated, 49. POWs, 34. Missing in action, 9. For a total of 456. Those that survived, 194. Total of men involved were 650. 6 medals of honor and a number of distinguished service crosses would be awarded for actions in, around, and over the so-called pocket. In a sad, significant postscript to the entire affair, Whittlesey, the Lost Battalion's commander, apparently took his own life in November of 1921, 3 years after the World War ended. A suicide, it appeared, meticulously planned. I wish they would let me forget, Whittlesey wrote. Not a day goes by but I hear from some of my old outfit, usually about some sorrow or a misfortune. I cannot bear much more. I want to be left in peace. On November 11th, 1921, the third anniversary of the end of the war, Whittlesey, with some 30 other Medal of Honor recipients, attended the interment of the first unknown soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. In the weeks to follow, Whittlesey, now a lieutenant colonel, drafted his own will and fine-tuned notes to his firm's pending law cases, ensuring, it now appears, that legal associates could seamlessly resume litigation in Whittlesey's stead. On Thanksgiving Day, 1921, Charles Whittlesey boarded SS Tulloch, a passenger-carrying freighter bound for Havana, Cuba. Through the course of his last day with the living, Whittlesey wrote a number of letters to close friends and relatives and a note to the ship's captain, providing detailed instructions for the disposition of the baggage left in his stateroom. Whittlesey spent the evening in the ship's saloon, engaged in casual conversation about the war with a passenger named Mollett. Abruptly, Whittlesey rose from the table and announced that he was going to bed. The Medal of Honor recipient, one of 3 members of the American Expeditionary Force described by General John J. Pershing as the 3 outstanding heroes of the World War, went out on deck and stepped over the rail and into eternity somewhere in the Atlantic. His body was never recovered. On a late February afternoon, 80 years later, Colonel Whittlesey took his life. It was on Hill 198 at the southern edge of the Claravoie Valley, looking into what was called the pocket. I stand as the military crest, peering north into the ravine, a sight that could not be seen below, a place where it was not familiar to Whittlesey at 5:15 p.m. on October 2nd. With imagination working, the military intuition reeling, I get a growing sense of understanding of how events may have unfolded before then, 80 years ago. At this point, the writer of this article is going to describe some things, and that's who you will hear from this point on incrementally. I have been to the site of the Lost Battalion's agonies on numerous occasions. Each time that I have departed, my spirit has been bothered by many questions. And therefore, why did Major Whittlesey choose the reverse slope to hunker down within arm's length of his objective instead of occupying the dominant high ground to the north and to the south? Why were 554 men at battalion and then some pinned down during the initial stages of the siege by a contingent, a fraction of their number? Even on warm days, with the sun shining overhead, the ravine remains cold and gloomy. The warming days cut off by a thick interlaced canopy of trees. The ground smells of rotting leaves, fertile soil, and mud with just a hint of sulfur from the marshy ground surrounding the brook. It is deathly quiet in the pocket. I slow my pace self-consciously, and one does who burst in on a church service in progress, suddenly, painfully aware of the faux pas. I fear that I am making too much noise for this hallowed ground. The story of the lost battalion cannot be completely understood without an examination of the command environment and associated chain of events that contributed to the saga of the ravine at Clairvaux. As a point of a departure, it is good to understand that the lost battalion was neither lost nor a battalion. The battalion was in fact a composite unit made up of companies A, B, and C of the 1st Battalion, commanded by Major Whittlesey, and companies E, G, and H of the 2nd Battalion, 308th Infantry Regiment, under the command of Captain George McMurtry. The unit also included Company K of the 307th Infantry under the command of Captain Nelson Haldeman, and Company C and D of the 306th Machine Gun Battalion. Whittlesey was the senior officer and therefore in command of the whole. As for being lost, nothing could be farther from the truth. The members of the lost battalion knew exactly where they were, trapped on a ravine slope and just below their objective, the road at Clairvaux Mill. The lost battalion's higher headquarters brigade, division corps up through the AEF, that's Allied Expeditionary Force, and General Pershing knew where they were. More important, the Germans overlooking the surrounding position knew exactly where they were. In fact, the Germans, members of the 76th Reserve Battalion, referred to the battalion in their communications as the American Nest. The Germans had occupied the region for some time and knew the area inside and out. They were not the best troops in Kaiser Wilhelm II's army, consisting largely of old reservists, but the difficult terrain of the Argonne Forest leveled the playing field. Capitalizing on the advantages of the defending the rough terrain, the Germans augmented the natural barriers of the forest with barbed wire obstacles, which therefore meticulously planned kill zones resulted. And therefore, with respect to the big picture, the American First Army was fresh off its first bloodletting, they were reducing at Saint-Mihiel salient, and was now engaged in the Meuse-Argonne offensive, part of the overall Allied operation under Marshal Foch. While the offensive had started off well for the Americans on September 26th, it had bogged down rapidly due to the combination of bad weather, restrictive terrain, and tough German resistance. Foch was impatient with the AEF's progress, noting that adjacent French armies seemed to be pulling ahead of American gains. The resulting gaps would concentrate a threat to the Allied flanks. Ranking members of the French command suggested that French staff officers be incorporated into the leadership of U.S. divisions. Foch, a man of action, now toyed with the notion of directing the French Second Army to take over the U.S. First Corps. Since the early days of the AEF involvement, General Pershing had waged a constant fight to keep the AEF together rather than piecemealed out to Allied forces. Pershing perceived Foch's plan as yet another attempt to parcel out the U.S. Army among Allied forces. Beside himself with anger and frustration, Pershing held off Foch's plan and demanded immediate action and results from his subordinate commanders across the Meuse-Argonne front. The pressure now levied on U.S. Corps and Division commanders to produce results was intense. A surprising twist to the Lost Battalion story, overshadowed by the hoopla of post-war legend, is the fact that Major Whittlesey's command was cut off and surrounded not once but twice in the 10-day period of September 28 to October 7. On September 28, the third day of the Meuse-Argonne Drive, Major Whittlesey and his 1st Battalion, the 308th Infantry, continued the attack north into the heart of the Argonne Forest. Following close in support was Captain McMurtry's 2nd Battalion, 308th Infantry. A stockbroker by trade, but an adventurer at heart, McMurtry had left Harvard University at the outbreak of the Spanish-American War to serve with Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders throughout the Cuban campaign. In 1917, he left Wall Street, this time to enlist and receive a commission as first lieutenant. McMurtry had a reputation as a rough and tumble, fearless yet cheerful commander, possessing boundless optimism, for which he was loved and respected by his troops. The going was tough, and Whittlesey's unit slugged it out, employing small platoon-sized groups of skirmishers to work through the thick, enemy-infested terrain. Captain McMurtry's battalion was in support of Whittlesey's main effort. Always looking for a good scrap, McMurtry used the frequent enemy contacts in the forest as an exercise to bring his command forward to fight alongside Whittlesey's battalion. At 5:15 p.m. on the 28th, Whittlesey's command had advanced to a point about a kilometer south of Bonarville. As the sun was setting, Whittlesey chose the reverse slope of Mount Haume, that's Dead Man's Hill, to establish the combined battalion headquarters for the night. Companies were placed in a square perimeter and runner posts established. Whittlesey's unit occupied the far left flank of the U.S. lines. Liaison between American and adjoining units had been poor in the forest, and on this date there had been no liaison at all. French units operating on Whittlesey's left and fallen back due to the stiff German resistance. A large gap now existed on the left flank. The Germans took advantage of it and, under the cover of darkness, infiltrated behind Whittlesey's force. By next morning, Whittlesey knew that his runner posts were cut off from the rear. He sent back a message by carrier pigeon to the 308th Regimental Headquarters, describing the situation and position of his unit. The regimental commander, Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Smith, directed that all detachments lost in the woods should be collected and reorganized for further orders. Then Colonel Smith took off with a small detachment to relieve his friend Whittlesey. Proceeding down a path that he believed led to Whittlesey's position, Smith's small detachment encountered a machine gun position. Smith called out to seek cover and was immediately wounded in the leg. Covering his men as they withdrew, Smith fired his .45 caliber semi-automatic into multiple machine gun positions, alerted to his presence. Smith fell again, this time severely wounded by a bullet in the side. Regaining his footing, he again fired into the German position until his men were safe. Refusing medical treatment, Smith obtained grenades with which to attack the enemy positions, but he was hit for a third time and fell mortally wounded. For his gallant efforts to reach Whittlesey's unit and to protect his own men, Smith was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor in February of 1919. He was the first Medal of Honor awarded to anyone in the Lost Battalion. Whittlesey continued to hold until late afternoon on September 30th, when elements of the 308th broke through and relieved the weary force. And thus ended the first chapter of the Lost Battalion saga. Major Whittlesey reported back to headquarters, where familiar orders were once again issued. Advance independently without regard for exposed flanks or contact with adjacent units. upon reaching the objective of the day, dig in and hold out for the rest of the division to catch up. Whittlesey protested up the chain of command that his unit was exhausted and down to half strength from the bitter fighting in the preceding days. The 77th Division commander, Major General Robert Alexander, aware of Pershing's state of mind and desiring to keep his job, flatly denied the request. The unit moved out in the attack, and as the sunlight faded after a long day of fighting, at 5:15 p.m. October 2nd, Whittlesey stood at the military crest of the north side of Hill 198, looking down into Claravoie Valley. In an examination and analysis of the terrain and situation some 80 years after the fact, I believe that Major Whittlesey crested Hill 198, realized it would soon be dark, and went down into the ravine to take the road, his objective, clearly seen from his position. Sacrificing security for speed, I suspect Major Whittlesey wanted to get his unit dug in and settled before the nightfall. There were three options available to him: pull back to a defendable terrain on Hill 198, get to the road and set up there, or three, press forward and take the high ground just north of the road. Heeding his orders and numerous threats about withdrawing from the ground once held, Whittlesey elected to hunker down on the reverse slope just under the objective and wait for the rest of the division to catch up. Back in the pocket, February 2000, in the valley, the floor is soft with odious calf-deep muck. The stream, about 2 meters wide, meanders lazily through the valley, running west to Claravoie Mill. To the left or to the west, there is a large pond. The stream was dammed sometime after the war was over and was an open field in 1918. With careful scanning, it is relatively easy to spot chunks of rusted shell that sliced through the ravine 80 years ago. On the west side of the stream, there are what would appear to be a number of small pools, 1 to 2.5 meters across. These are the old shell holes dug by mortar and artillery rounds that rained into the pocket for 5 days. A misguided American artillery barrage meant to relieve German pressure on the unit probably made the number of these holes. Somewhere back in the rear, a U.S. field artillery officer had transposed the map coordinates for the American positions. The friendly barrage fell on the American positions. Our own artillery is dropping a barrage directly on us, read the last carrier pigeon message. For heaven's sake, stop it. On the north side of the stream are the remains of an old road. While little more than a path today, this road would have provided a high-speed avenue of approach from the east or from the west into Whittlesey's position. Seeing this, Whittlesey had divided the 9 available machine guns to cover both ends of the road, protecting his flanks. The slope of the hill rises to the road. About 75 meters is steep and difficult to climb. The soil is loose and rocky, and at times arms and legs are both needed to keep from sliding back. The men of the Lost Battalion dug their funk holes right into the side of the hill, which provided a modicum of protection from the plunging fire from the German positions above. It did not, however, provide cover from the machine gun fire coming from the reoccupied German positions across the ravine. With a desire to understand the situation presented to a trapped rifleman in the pocket, I plopped down into the number of remaining fighting positions to get a feel of the terrain. There is no rhyme or reason to the spacing or disposition of the pits. They're placed where I imagine exhausted soldiers found some room to dig. I hunkered down into each position, trying to determine available fields of fire from the hole. In all positions, fields of fire and observation north is limited to the crest of the road. If I lift my head and body high enough to see the cliff, I know I could have been seen from the German positions above. From that position in October 1918, as the old infantryman's adage goes, if you can be seen, you can be hit. And if you can be hit, you can be killed. Observation and fields of fire are relatively clear for 50 to 75 meters or more on the east and west flanks. A variety of artifacts is strewn in and around the positions. My eye catches an unfired U.S. 30-06 bullet resting on some moss plainly visible. The bullet, tarnished brown with age, is in an otherwise good shape, the primer intact. Chambered into a rifle today, I'd bet a case of beer it would fire. The bullet holds its own secrets. Ammunition in the Lost Battalion's position was at a premium, and resupply meant stripping a dead buddy's body of remaining ammunition. How and why was this bullet here? What the men in the pocket endured is difficult to comprehend, more so to explain. The time dragged on. Machine gun fire, mortars, grenades, flamethrowers, cold, thirst, and hunger all took their toll. Hardened soldiers wept at the pitiful moans of wounded comrades beyond help, hanging on to life in adjacent funk holes. Sticky, blood-soaked bandages and puttees were removed from the dead to use for the living. Each morning, Whittlesey would arrange burial details. Burying the dead was hard work for men weakened by starvation and exposure. Digging was done at best from a kneeling position, but most commonly lying on one side. Any clink of an entrenching shovel against a rock or an observed flutter of movement was answered with a hail of machine gun fire from the opposite ridgelines. During the frequent mortar and artillery attacks, interred commands would at times be blown free of their hasty graves to rejoin their living soldiers in the camped funk holes. And yet, the living members of the Lost Battalion hung on. Whittlesey, McMurtry, and Haldeman regularly made the rounds to each funk hole, offering words of encouragement to their men. McMurtry would often say, "It's all right, boys. Everything's practically okay." Legendary accounts claim that Whittlesey shouted, "Go to hell," as a response to a German appeal to surrender. The reality is that Whittlesey said nothing and ordered the white panels laid out as a signal for aircraft taken in, lest, by mistake, it was a white flag of surrender. In an almost anticlimactic spin of fortune, the Germans, feeling pressure from the attacks to the north, pulled out of the area surrounding the pocket. At 7 p.m. October 7, 5 days into the ordeal, the first U.S. patrols made contact with the Lost Battalion, not relieving it, but incorporating it into friendly lines. On the Clairvaux Road, looking down into the pocket, February 2000, the sun has dropped beyond the hill. It won't be long now before night covers the pocket. In keeping with the personal tradition stated at least 6 visits ago, I pull my bottle of French wine from the trunk of the car and raise it in salute to the men of the Lost Battalion. After a hearty draw, I consider the slope of the pocket momentarily and try to imagine the view 80-some years ago. In my mind's eye, I see a sea of tin hats below me, pale, dirty faces rimmed with black, grimy stubble peer up from their funk holes with a fixed melancholy stare. Then a genuine insight occurs. There were 554 men jammed in a 300 by 60 yard box. They all were bunched up so that only those on the perimeter of the defense could engage me. Fields of fire are severely restricted for those in the middle. The lost battalion can only bring a fraction of its available firepower to bear in any direction. Those in the middle can only be marginally combat effective in a ground attack. Major Whittlesey, a citizen soldier like so many others in the AEF, had been promoted beyond his martial experience and abilities. He had made a junior officer mistake. In his desire, largely due to an oppressive command environment, to attain and hold the objective, combined with a need to keep all in his charge together and under immediate personal control, Whittlesey had bunched 554 men together on the side of a hill within arm's reach of his objective. In his mind, he had accomplished his mission in establishing his force on the hillside, bunched as they were. Whittlesey unconsciously allowed an internally smaller force to find, fix, and gradually hack away at his command with mortars, grenades, and machine gun fire. The saving grace in the end was Whittlesey's decision to use the reverse slope, which provided the 1st Battalion with a modicum of cover and concealment from observed fire. The sun has set, the pocket is dark. It will be another year at least before I return to visit the Lost Battalion. I will be back, in spite of the fact that I now have some notion of how a smaller German force was able to find, fix, and pick apart. Whittlesey's command, a bigger question, now lingers. Within the heroic legend that blossomed from the misery of the Lost Battalion, a gray core remains begging the question, was all this necessary? It is a question that I am sure rested heavily on Charles Whittlesey's mind as he mounted the rail of the SS Talloa and peered into the black waters below. There were seven men who received the Medals of Honor because of this particular engagement. We don't have time for me to read these, but I do want to let you know who they are. Of course, the first one is Charles W. Whittlesey. He was born in Florence, Wisconsin. George G. McMurtry. He was from New York. At least he actually joined the army there. His birthplace was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Nelson M. Holderman. He was born in Trumbull, Nebraska. Harold Ernest Gettler. He was born in Chicago, Illinois. Irwin B. Bleckley, born in Wichita, Kansas. Benjamin Kaufman, who was born in Buffalo, New York. And finally, Archie Peck, who was born in Tyrone's, New York State. Up north, there was a famous battle called the Somme. And when that was over, the death toll there was as horrific as we've just noted in the Lost Battalion. John McCrae wrote a bit of a poem, short one, about that particular battle, and it's called In Flanders Fields. Here's how it reads. In Flanders Fields the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row. They mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from falling hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If we break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields. That's World War I. Today is the 100th anniversary of the conclusion of that war. The armistice was signed in Europe on November the 11th of 1918, at I think at 11 o'clock in the morning. So this is approximately 11 o'clock here in Central Time. And so we salute all those who fell in World War I. In the second session, we're going to move to World War II, and we're going to fight the Battle of Iwo Jima. It's now 10:30. It's time for us to take our usual break for tea and crumpets. We'll reassemble here at 10 minutes till the hour.